Vera Payne.
Grading is one of the most essential activities in education. Teachers can't help educate if they don't know how their students are learning. But according to some experts, the current grading system is unfair and inaccurate. Joining me to speak about the issues in grading and how we can make it fair is Professor Emeritus in the College of Education at the University of Kentucky. Thanks for joining me, Thomas.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
So tell me, what are your thoughts on traditional grading?
Well, a lot depends on how we define traditional grading. In most cases, it's people that have gone through school getting letter grades and report card, or in some cases now we're using percentage grades. And it's really not a question of, you know, the grades themselves. Letters or numbers or even words are just categories assigned to different levels of student performance. It's really how those grades are determined and then how we interpret those grades. That's where the problems arise.
Now, I know from personal experience, and I know a lot of listeners out there can relate to this, is you got a mixture of both in school. In grammar school, I had A through F. And then in high school, it was percentages and A through F. And then in college, It was more percentages than any kind of letter grade. So when it comes down to it, why is it all mixed up?
Well, it's because there's probably not another area in all of education where there's a greater gap between our knowledge base that's been established by the research we've done in this area and our practice. I mean, in the United States in particular, we are more bound by tradition in grading than we are any kind of evidence base whatsoever. In fact, we're a bit behind the rest of the world in doing this. So many of these practices that we maintain in grading throughout elementary, middle schools, and high schools, we do just because we've always done it that way. When we look for more sort of progressive grading practices or things that are being done more in line with what our research indicates would be better practices, we have to look to places like Canada, where they are less bound by these traditions.
Now, do you think that the reason why there's such discrepancies across the board is because it's not a federal thing, it's a local thing? So like in Illinois, when you're in high school, it's mandatory to take swimming. So I'm not sure if it's mandatory in any other state. So it kind of differs from state to state. Is this something like we should have the same thing across every state?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, even if we look at grading practices, they differ drastically from district to district, even school to school within a district, and even classroom to classroom within a school. Now, we are, again, a bit behind other places in the world. If you go to Canada, for example, in the province of Ontario, in Ontario, they have standards for their education system, just like Illinois does. They have the same kind of assessment system that all schools in Illinois would be using. And because of that, they have adopted this system whereby the entire province uses the same kind of report card. We here in the United States, though, even though every state does have state standards, they have state assessment systems, they have state accountability regulations, it's still left to every individual school to develop its reporting policies and practices and even a unique report card.
So what would this new type of grading system look like? Is it something that, you know, would help everybody out? Like, how would it help even?
Well, there are a couple of things we could do, and it would get back to where we started with really looking at how the grades are determined and how they're interpreted. In terms of how the grades are interpreted, our strong research evidence indicates that it's really essential that we base students' grades on learning criteria, not upon what we call norm-based criteria. And by that I mean we need to grade based on what students have learned and what they're able to do, not according to their relative standing among classmates. I mean, this is what we call grading on the curve. And the research evidence on this is very consistent, that if you grade students on the curve, it makes learning very competitive. Students have to compete against each other for the few scarce high grades the teacher is going to give out. It actually destroys the relationship of collaboration among students. It makes the relationship between teachers and students more complicated, too, because when teachers begin helping one student, you're not helping others, and then it interferes with the competition. When we grade according to specific learning criteria, all those things are reversed. Now you have a grade that actually does communicate what you want students to learn and are able to do. Students can actually compete, but they're competing against the curriculum, not against each other. That means you facilitate, you know, collaboration. And it actually puts teachers and students on the same side out to master those particular learning goals. Plus, it can prompt really important conversations about, are those goals the right goals? Are they sufficiently rigorous? Meaningful conversations, rather than comparing one student to the other in things that really don't make sense.
You know, this sounds really good, and I like the idea that there would be more collaboration, there will be more critical thinking. Mm-hmm. What I'm concerned about is, let's say you did this in high school, and then they went to college, mm-hmm. and it's a totally different grading system. So the things that you were taught to do in high school is not how it's going to happen in college. So mm-hmm. does that mean that we need to change all of the grading within every level of schooling? Or how would that work?
Our research based on grading, and where we came to understand this in better ways, actually began with a project we initiated in 2016. In 2016, the American Educational Research Association was celebrating its 100th year anniversary, and they put a call out to the field for various researchers to take on the task of trying to summarize the research in different aspects of education over that 100-year period. So together with my friend Susan Brookhart, we put together a really amazing team of scholars that had been investigating the issues of grading and reporting to comprise a sort of a synthesis of all that research. It was then published in Review of Education Research. We put it together in a book that we called What We Know About Grading. And it's that set of evidence that has pushed us toward a recognition of what is better practice in grading and what can contribute to student success and what cannot. Now, are those practices commonly employed at all grade levels? No. I mean, there's tremendous variation, even among universities. I mean, we find that some universities are really attuned to really excellent grading practices and policies, and others are doing things that we know are actually counter to what we should be doing. And so you found great variation within each of the institutions. But I don't think necessarily that doing something in high school would be dictated by what's done in college. I mean, the college level is the only level of education at which people can enter and begin teaching with no training in pedagogy. So that means that, you know, at that level, you can typically find examples of pretty poor teaching. And students are going to encounter that. But that doesn't mean the best way to prepare students for poor teaching in college is to teach them poorly in high school. The best preparation we can offer students in high school would be to really learn excellently what we have to teach them in the high school curriculum. That's the best preparation we could offer. And similarly with grading. I mean, I don't think we prepare students for poor grading practices by grading them poorly today. We should do it in ways that are defensible and ways that are actually supportive of learning. And then hopefully when they encounter situations that are less defensible or less supportive, they'll be able to succeed and find their way through that.
Now, I know a lot of educators out there do think that there is something wrong with the grading system. It needs to be changed. But a lot of parents mm-hmm. and a lot of people out there just think, well, I made through it. They can too. Bill Gates, mm-hmm. Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, we all went through some of this. Some of our best people have. So why change it now?
Well, I think it's because recognizing how some of those old practices have actually been detrimental to students. I mean, for example, everybody can probably recall being in a class where you were graded according to your standing among classmates, where you were graded on the curve. And when that occurs, what happens is we remember how we sort of hated those students with the high scores because they blew off the curve. And then we were hesitant to help anybody else be successful because that would be detrimental to your chances for success. Now, even though we grew up under that system, it doesn't mean that that system worked for anybody. When we change that and start saying, no, your grade is not dependent upon how anybody else does. Your grade is really going to depend on what you've learned and what you're able to do. And helping someone else doesn't hurt your chances for success. It might actually facilitate it or complement it. So I think by making these changes, we can steer all students, and there are not only students, but parents and families' understandings of what grades mean, in a much more positive direction that will benefit everybody.
Now, one of the things I'm thinking of is when I was in grammar school, there was probably 25 of us per class. Mm-hmm. My sister, her son, is in a class, I believe, with 35, and I have friends who have, the classrooms are filled. Would these type of grading systems work with classrooms that are that big?
Well, there is a challenge associated with this. In fact, that's one of the reasons that we've adopted different grading practices. I mean, prior to, you know, this grading is really a relatively recent phenomenon in education. I mean, early on, when we first began having schooling here in the United States, grading or reporting was basically done by teachers visiting children's homes and talking with the parents and explaining what they were doing well and where they needed to work a little bit harder. It wasn't until the late 1800s when we began passing these mandatory education laws. Massachusetts was the first state to do it in 1852, and then other states began following suit. The very last state to adopt a mandatory education law was actually Mississippi, and that wasn't until 1918. But as these mandatory education laws were being passed, the number of children in school began to increase drastically. And then more and more students were not only then finishing the elementary grades, but then continuing on to high school. And as this number of students began to increase, the challenge of grading reporting became all the more serious for teachers, and they had to develop shorthand ways of doing it. So that's when initially we started with sorted percentage grades. People saw how unreliable and inconsistent teachers were in assigning percentage grades, so we adopted then the letter grade sort of system of fewer categories, and that pretty much took place like in 1920s, 1930s. But it was just really a shorthanded way of trying to communicate information about how kids were doing in school to parents and families that compelled us to move to these more shorthanded methods. The criteria by which we put students into those categories still was left to the discretion of individual teachers. And that's one of the dilemmas we're facing today, trying to get greater consistency in those kinds of measures across teachers within the same school, at least.
Now, how long do you think it would take to implement something like this? Let's say, like, is there a voting process? Could you start in just one school district? Or, you know, is this something that everybody has to agree on?
Well, no. What we're finding, especially here in the United States, is that grading is pretty much a local prerogative. And so grading policies are established by individual school districts. What you'll find, even there in the state of Illinois, is from district to district, grading policies differing drastically. Some are moving toward, you know, more sort of standards-based orientation, and some are not. Some are still bound to traditional. Some are using percentage grades. Some are using letter grades. Some are, you know, abandoning this notion of class rank, and others are still maintaining it. So you just have tremendous differences from district to district. And then even within a district, you can have differences across levels. So what the elementary people do could be different from the middle school people. That could be different from the high school people. There's a lot of local prerogative that still is the primary source of where we develop our grading policies and practices.
You know, when you first read about this stuff, it really just sounds like trying to take away the D's and the F's. But really, it's about making sure that they understand what's going out there. And that makes more sense to me. These articles are kind of not doing your message justice.
Well, one of the things, too, I wanted to maybe take the time to talk about was this. You know, one of the major things that's going on in the country right now is that schools are recognizing this tremendous increase in number of failing grades. Minneapolis, for example, saw a 5-time increase in number of failing grades. Salt Lake City saw 7 times increase. Districts in California around San Francisco and San Diego. And when they began looking at these grades more carefully, they found that teachers consider all these different kinds of criteria when they assign grades. And we put these criteria into 3 different groups. We have sort of product criteria, which are demonstrations of learning, what the kids are learning, are able to do. We have process criteria, and those are really criteria that don't represent learning per se, are enabled learning process. So if you count homework, you're getting in terms of process. If you count class participation, if you count effort, if you count engagement, all those are sort of process criteria. And finally, we have progress. And with progress, you don't really concern yourself with where they are, but how far they've come. So in essence, a student could make great progress, could still be achieved below grade level. Now, what tends to happen is that teachers, because of established grading policies in their school or district, they combine all 3 of those into a single grade. Researchers call it a hodgepodge grade. But when these districts started looking at these failing grades and they started separating those elements, they found that kids were still learning. It's just they were getting failing grades because they weren't compliant. They weren't turning in their homework, these process-oriented things. And what they've started to do is they've started actually reporting those separately to, instead of combining everything into one grade, they're providing sort of profile of information and reporting those separately on the report card and then on the even on transcript. I mean, when other schools have done this for decades, Canadian schools have done this for, 20 years. But when they do that, in some districts, they cut the number of failing grades by 60%. It was huge. And so it relates directly to issues of equity, because in many cases, these sort of non-academic factors to be included in the grades are things over which the kids don't have any control. You know, maybe they, they're at home, but they don't complete the homework assignment because as soon as they got home, they're called upon to take on childcare responsibilities for younger siblings, or there's not a quiet place for them to get away to do it in the home. And when they found they started pulling these non-achievement factors out, the kids were actually learning. It was just that they were getting failing grades because of these non-academic things. And I think that's a really important sort of equity issue that we need, more people need to understand.
I think of that, and you're right. There's a lot of things that happens in children's lives where they're given adult responsibilities. But I also think to myself of the teachers, teacher bias. And the reason I say that is from my own experience. When I was in high school, I was a senior, and I was failing because I didn't want to be there. I didn't go to my classes. I had issues at home, absolutely. One of the things, though, is that my teacher, who didn't have tenure, told me I'm not ruining his chance to get tenure. So he stood behind me, gave me the answers to the American history test because he wanted his tenure. I think of that often. How many other people have gone through that where they just push you along because the teacher is more concerned about their position, their life? And, a lot of people, we are all involved in our own life. But then the other part, too, is if a teacher has tenure and they just don't like you, let me lower your grade even more. And that happens a lot, too. So, the letter grade for me is at least a way for you to get past those barriers. You have to put a little bit of effort into what you're doing. And it also stops the teacher from trying to mess around with the system a little bit. There's got to be a check and balance to it. And just putting up effort, do I think they learned? I don't know. I don't know. they need to take a test to figure out if they can even apply it. It's very tricky. And it's a hard subject to trying to figure out. There's so many human factors involved.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And you're so right, too, that this can be so corrupted in such a way. You want to look at, there's some really great research that's been conducted by a fellow whose name is David Quinn. David Quinn's out of Brown University, and he was interested in very similar factors to what you're talking about. He did this study where he had teacher score essays a student had written, but he attached student names to the essays. And in the first instance, he attached names that students of students that were clearly identified as sort of African-American students. And he found that there was a very strong bias, negative, and lowering the grades of these students. But then what he did is he had the teachers really be trained in using a rubric to identify and to score writing samples. And he found that when teachers really were compelled to use specific criteria in scoring these writing samples, it completely eliminated this bias that had been a part of their evaluations before.
Wow.
I think so. We can do things in grading that are really moving us in a very positive direction to be fairer to students and to be more honest in our representation of their performance. We don't have to be tainted and biased and prejudiced in these ways. It's just helping educators understand that to make use of it.
Well, Thomas, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate you being here. And for those listening, where can they find more information about you?
Well, I do have a website where there is lots of articles and reports on grading. That's just at tguski.com. You can also contact me through my email here. I'm Professor Emeritus at the University of Kentucky, and my email address is guski@uky.edu. I'm welcome hearing from anybody.
This has been the Mason Vera Payne Show. Thanks for listening. Can't wait to hear more? Head to WGNradio.com for exclusive content by Mason. Also, follow Mason on Facebook and Twitter @MasonVeraPayne, that's all one word, and don't forget to share the show with your friends.